Okay, and then so to start off, I was just curious what initially the grad student movement.
Well, I'm, very pro-union in terms of my politics. And so as soon as I became a grad student, like basically as soon as I was on campus, I sought the union out and joined and wanted to know how I could get involved. Because I think it's politically and practically a really important thing for to join and get involved with your union, whatever the workplace is.
Were you aware of them as like an undergraduate student?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't do my undergrad at UCSB. I did it in Chicago, but but I was around in. So I grew up in Santa Barbara, and I used to work for DSA along many, many years ago for the Democratic Socialists of America. And so back in the late 90s, early 2000s, with the strikes and fights for recognition, for the union's recognition were happening. I happened to be back in Santa Barbara and talked with some of the people who were meeting it. So I'd been aware of the struggle. It certainly was like a thing that was written about in progressive magazines and newspapers and so forth. So it's something I'd been following and supportive of. And so I was excited to be able to be involved with it after it was established when I actually got to grad school.
Okay. What kind of progressive magazines and newspapers? Was it like campus specific or just like Santa
No,
Barbara in general?
neither. I mean, because it was a nationwide phenomenon, right, of this category of workers starting to organize again, I should say, in the 90s. Because, and I don't know how much of this you've uncovered in your research, but there have been different waves of graduate student organizing going back to the 30s at Berkeley. So back in the CIO days. And then another wave like in the 60s. And at one point there was a local union representing graduate employees, but just at Berkeley. So it was a long struggle and a bunch of different steps to it, and the kind of like big event, at least for the UC, right, was that recognition in 2000 or around 2000. And that's where the union, this was the largest group of academic student employees now represented by a union. It was, it's the UC, the flagship public university system in the country. So it was a really big deal. But it had been a long time coming. And so generations of graduate student employees had. And I still see this come up in left circles where people are like, oh, yeah, I was fighting that back when I was in graduate school in the 70s. Yeah, so I was aware of it. And so, you could read about it in The Nation and in These Times. So certainly if you did like a less LexisNexis search for that, you can get a lot of stuff. And then there's one of the organizers, UAW organizers, when I was there, Ricardo Ochoa, who's now a labor attorney. He wrote a piece for like the Public Employment Law Journal for California, like a very academic law journal, I think it was. But he wrote a piece that's like a whole chronological history of organizing at the UC that'll give you a time frame of like when the first locals were organized, when the affiliate exactly when the affiliation with the UAW happened and everything, because I'm a little shaky on the dates. But all of that is obviously very accessible. And that'll give a little bit of a counterbalance to like the academic articles that the dissident groups in the union have published over the years, that Sullivan published it at Santa Barbara, and there was like people at Santa Cruz and so forth.
And are those publications, so how exactly do those publications differ from Ricardo's?
Oh no, it's more so like, and Amanda, as you were alluding to, right, there's always been like different philosophical strains in the union, and like one of the things that's been a hallmark of the like self-proclaimed leftist radicals in the union is that, they like to write academic theoretical articles about the union. So there's like a paper trail of like that kind of thinking in the union, critical of the UAW, critical of collective bargaining, critical of you know, mainstream political work, all of that. Mm-hmm. So there's just been a bunch of those articles written in academic journals or left publications, like political publications, far fewer things published from the more, you know, you say institutional factions in the union, or, you know, because like personally, you know, when I was a union leader, I was always very careful with what I would say about the union or write about the union. And I certainly didn't, even though I had my own critiques and my own thoughts, like my instinct or my feeling was that that was best like talked about within the union. Let's like talk about it, work it out, you know, deal with it. Not like I'm gonna write an academic article and seem really smart about shitting on my own union. So that was always like a cultural difference between the two tendencies.
I'll definitely look into that paper trail, because that'd be really a great resource to have.
Yeah, it'll be good for underpinning if you do other interviews and stuff, like underpinning things with the facts. And let me know, you can hit me up on Facebook Messenger or whatever. Let me know if you're having trouble finding them. I'll help you find them. They're all going to be easy for you to track down with your library access.
Okay, yeah, perfect. Thank you. And so can you just tell me a little bit more about like what your role was within the UAW and like how long you served?
Sure. So I was active for over 10 years. So it was like pretty much my entire grad school time, which was, you know, a little on the long side, not unrelated to me spending a lot of time on the union and other political things. But yeah, so I got involved my first year in the sociology department and became a head steward for the campus. And then I was the campus unit chair, so like the lead steward on the campus. Then was elected to the state board, executive board, and eventually was vice president. And then very briefly served as president before like we were all wiped out in an election, like all of my generation of leaders, in a really gross, like contentious election that taught me a lot about like some of the bad tendencies on the political left.
So that was another thing I was going to ask about, like the rift between like I think it was USAGE and ADU are the two political caucuses that I came across. So what was that kind of like election process for you from your side of things?
Yeah, well, I mean, so there had been pretty much the whole time that I was involved, there had been a kind, like I said, a kind of informal political division. That people, it wasn't like hard factions, but at certain times it would kind of solidify into factions over particular issues. But it would flare up over a lot of symbolic stuff, as well as programmatic things. But I'd say that the core difference was the institutional side, or my faction, or what we eventually called ourselves, USAGE, though that was just really for that election. You know, we were very focused on the like nuts and bolts of power in regards to the university. So very focused on staying at majority membership, which for this bargaining unit, right, which has tremendous turnover just by nature of the work, was constant work. I mean, it was like, as an officer, I was expected, as a statewide officer, I was expected to spend over 20 hours a week on the ground signing up new members. And so when we would recruit new activists, it'd be like, okay, yeah, you want to talk politics and talk about the labor movement and how it's going to change society. That's awesome. But we also have to go to the chemistry department and the physics department and earth sciences and chemistry and talk to people who are not radical about why they should join the union. And that was like hard, exhausting work. And on the other hand, you had people who were like, I want to be in the union movement because I'm a socialist and I'm a radical and fuck capitalism and I get to be in a trade union, which is great. Like, that's fantastic. That's why a graduate student, you know, from sociology or English or something might, and not to stereotype, there were radicals in sciences too, but fewer of them. But anyway, that's a motivation they had for coming into the movement. But like, there was there were real bureaucratic realities about how power relation works between teaching assistants and the university. And we just really emphasized that. So there would be flare-ups about contract negotiations where, for example, they would always want to just like come up with the perfect contract, hold out for the most perfect language in the contract. And our thing would be more, let's really concentrate on the things that are about union security and like dispute mechanisms and grievance handling procedures, stuff that seems boring and bureaucratic. Because if you're actively out in the departments talking to the workers and filing those grievances, that's how you build up a case in the next round of negotiations to like win more rights or win more benefits, right? You can come in and say, now we want really strict regulations on workload because look, for the last 2 years of our contract, we filed 400 workload violation grievances, right? So it was like always like our way of going about things was like building systematically and very much about stay at majority and so forth. The other thing that we concentrated a lot on in my generation in the union was always looking for new groups of workers to organize. So never being satisfied with like, okay, we got the grad students. We were always out looking to expand. So I was an organizer, temporary organizer on the campaign to organize the postdocs at the UC, which was successful. So we people that were a little bit before my time in the union had done all the heavy lifting for organizing the union for teaching assistants at the CSUs, which was huge. So here we were like doubling and tripling the number of academic student workers organized. So it wasn't our biggest priority to like have the kinds of like meetings and program that a radical sociologist would be the most interested in week to week. And like if I had it to do over and looking back, we should have been more flexible about this and given people like let people start their committee on radical transformation of consciousness. Fine. You know, like one big fight we had internally was the left always really wanted a newsletter. Mm. They wanted to write articles and you know, it's the left. They like to think and blah, blah, blah. So, and like our organizing reps from UAW were like very against that. They're like, it's a giant time sink. It's not organizing anybody new. It's not realigning power with the university. It's just like people spouting off. But I saw that it was just like a really important thing to certain kinds of activists. And they really wanted like a newsletter for people to read in their department. And I mean, there were reasons for it. They wanted it. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to me like an easy compromise to make, but didn't. And that became like another like line in the sand that was like, they won't even let us have a newsletter and so forth. So, it kind of came to a head in the contract negotiations. It was like the last set of contract negotiations in my tenure. And that was like, we really definitely had like two blocks on the bargaining team.
Mm. And what do you mean by blocks? Sorry.
Two factions, two groups.
Oh, okay.
Like these debates and these arguments that had been more informal. And like I said, people kind of moving back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
As we started the bargaining process, people kind of chose sides.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so basically we came up with a contract, or like we agreed to a draft contract with the university. It was in our mind a very good contract, especially for it was in the middle of the recession. Every other union in the UC system had given concessions,
mm-hmm.
Of some kind. We had no concessions. We had wage increases, we had increases in rights, we had a family benefit, like a paid family leave and paid childcare benefits for the first time ever in anybody's contract like this. So we were really excited about it. But the like radical side was like, we should have stayed out, gone on strike, gotten an even more perfect contract. And we were like, this is a great contract for us to build on. It's only 2 years. Let's like file a ton of grievances, get to 70% membership, scare the fuck out of the university, and then we can like go at it again.
Mm-hmm.
But So they actually started, this is was the birth of AWDU as a statewide thing, was to start a campaign to vote down the proposed contract. Mm-hmm. And so we really, so it was like the two factions went head to head in the election of whether to ratify this draft contract. And we won. The contract was ratified. Mm-hmm. But that like solidified AWDU as a group. So they started more and more campaigning. Then the next year, Occupy happened. The Occupy Wall Street, Occupy LA, Occupy campuses, Occupy everything. And there was this huge sort of swelling on campus of activism aimed at, you know, the budget cuts and fee increases, and was very radical. And then Occupy was happening, and people were like coming up with these theories that if we sit in this park for years, we'll win, we'll beat capitalism or something. And there was also this real ethos in Occupy that it was like, and this is like typical of what happens in like the second term of a moderate Democrat president, right? Is that the left is like, fuck, we put up with all these compromises and shit. Like, fuck this, you know, fuck the Democrats. So the AWDU campaigned on like, they get like, we could get better contracts by like being more militant and going on strike. This leadership works with the Democratic Party. And look, the president, DeRocca, he's even an officer in the Democratic Party. That's horrible. Like, the Democratic Party hates workers. Occupy, militancy, blah, blah. And they just like went around, told everybody this. We were just so unprepared for like their use of social media, and really unprepared for like their dirtbag tactics. Like, we didn't expect them to do certain things that they did, like follow us around, our people around, holding signs with completely made up salaries on them, mm-hmm. saying that we made $100,000 a year, $90,000 a year working for the union, and we were bureaucrats and all this shit. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, following us around with those, like, we were like, we're your fellow fucking grad student. Like, why are you doing this? This is great. So, and part of it was that a few of the leaders of AWDU had gone into graduate school from the labor movement, where they had been involved in some of the most vicious internal union versus union battles in the healthcare sector. So NUHW versus UHW. And that those battles were like just vicious. I mean, doxing, name calling, calling management on each other, like just every dirty, dirty business fighting over who was going to control these contracts in the healthcare sector. So you know, these people had like learned how to do inter-union battles that way. So they like started websites where they were like photoshopping our faces onto like Ho Chi Minh and Stalin and shit, and just gross, very personal attacks. Mm-hmm. And it won. And I learned, you know, like going up to UC Davis, where I'd spent a lot of time as a vice president of the union, going up there, filing lots of grievances, worked really hard on this grievance in the Spanish department, where we won like every TA in the Spanish department thousands of dollars because there had been a systematic like breaking of the rules. And we went all the way to arbitration. And it was like, I was a graduate student flying up to Davis, going through arbitration to win my fellow workers this money and all this stuff. And then I was going up there during the campaign, and it was just like the Spanish department all voted against us because they had a leader in, there was like an AWDU person there who went around with just the easiest narrative to say. You know how unions are corrupt and they always just support the Democrats? Well, we want a different kind of union. We want to be militant and radical and be like Occupy and get rid of those bureaucrats. People were like, sure, bam. I mean, it was like playing into all the anti-union stereotypes that there are out there in the general public and everything. It was really soul crushing. And it took me quite a while to recover from it, like sort of emotionally and psychologically. I mean, the upside personally was like, then I was out of the union. And so I just went concentrated on my dissertation and actually finished it and graduated. So that was good. But it really sucked. I mean, it really was like, man, we are on the same side. We might have some differences in strategy and so forth, but you took it to 11 for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I didn't know how deep seated like the rift really was. But yeah, it must've been like a lot to go.
It was among the leadership. It was really, really deep seated. I think among the membership, it wasn't so much. I mean, I think the membership was like, you know, I mean, one thing I learned in organizing in academia, right, is like the sociology of the department is so important. And there are certain people, graduate students in any department, who are seen as leaders, and other people who are not seen as leaders and kind of not respected. And so if one of the respected graduate students is like, the union is good, it's very helpful, lots of people will sign up. They'll be like, this is a normal thing, this is what you do. Mm-hmm. If that person is like, we do things differently in our department and we don't need the union, or the union's not radical enough or whatever, that just like, that becomes the conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you say that like, because there are so many like different directions within the elites, it kind of like pulled a lot of grad students in different directions?
Well, for sure. I mean, I think what happened afterwards, and you can talk to people, get their side of it, but from sort of outside and talking to people who were still on staff, like what happened was the union became a radical activist left organization very quickly. So like right away, they started this thing of becoming pro BDS. Right. And so, and they took that vote to the membership. So the membership voted on whether to endorse BDS. And you had all of these Jewish graduate students or other graduate students who were, you know, with particular ties to or sentiments about Israel being like, why is my union taking up this issue? Like, I'm for my union. I want better wages and working conditions in my, but like, why are we talking about Israel, Palestine? Mm-hmm. So a bunch of people left the union because it won, of course, because the turnout was highest in the radical departments. And so, you know, the union became, so the union for teaching assistants and readers and tutors at UC, you know, gave its thumbs up to BDS, lost a bunch of members. Palestine didn't get free. I mean, it was just, so there was things like that. And then it was just was like, we're radical, we're left, we're so forth. So membership just went down. They stopped the like treadmill tough program of organizing that we had, just that was brutal. And we probably could have done a better job of kind of working people into it, but like, but membership went into the toilet. And so then they had a long contract fight, like went to impasse, stayed out, went on strike, got a good contract as far as the contract itself. But they'd gone so long without a contract that the wage increases that they got for the contract actually were less than what they lost by working on without the contract. So, but you really got the point that it wasn't about that. It was about, we want to be in a union that's on strike and that is militant. And it's like, for some people, that's awesome. And that's what they want out of their union. But for most of the membership, you have to convince them to join the union because they've grown up in a viciously anti-union culture in the United States. And so getting that, I would rather have 80% of the graduate students or teaching assistants, I should say, because it's also undergraduates, readers, tutors, I'd rather have 80% membership of the people that the union represents than have 30% membership of the most militant, coolest, most down Marxist badasses. Mm-hmm. And that was, to me, what the split came down to. And so membership has been in the fucking garbage can for years now. And I think that my sense is that the newest group of statewide leaders have recognized that or trying to turn it around. I've had a couple conversations with a couple of them. They seem like they're trying to get things going. But there's like, and this, by the way, to sound like old guy talking to young activists, this is like an iron law of the left, I think, right? It's like splits. So ADU split, right? And there was like people that, okay, so right away after they took power, they purged some people. And then there were splits. And so there's like no ADU anymore, I don't think. There's like a new thing. But anyway, it's like inevitable, of course, because once you, when your politics become, how, how do we be the most radical and the most left? Like, you, that is a unwinnable game. Mm-hmm. Someone can always be more radical, right? Mm-hmm. It was, my understanding is that in terms of power vis-a-vis the university, the union went downhill. Mm-hmm. And that was our number one priority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When things started kind of like breaking up and like splitting up within the party, was there, because I know that a lot of their tactics were like spreading all these like rumors and like information about members, like elite members in the UAW. So was there ever like an effort on that side of things to try to like explain kind of the process or like the reasoning behind?
Yeah, we fucked up on that. I mean, that was like, we learned too late the power of the email and social media. I mean, not that we didn't know those things, but in terms of this election, we really thought that our very old fashioned, which I think in general is like the best way to build a union, of going face to face, talking to people was the most important, was like the thing. So we just did a program of just having people out talking to people while they were just spamming and putting up and like doing these blogs, like shitty attacking us blogs and so forth. And we were like, that's all lies. We're not going to respond. We're certainly not going to hit back. The other thing was that, and this was like a political question about constituencies, their base constituencies were the social sciences and humanities in Northern California, in the Northern California campuses, and a little bit in some of the Southern California campuses. So, and our bases of support were like more in Southern California and like the not social science departments. But those members they didn't give a fuck about this internal thing, right? I mean, like, that was the thing, was our base was not engaged, and we didn't do a good job of like, we should have just gotten dirty and scared them. We should have played the other side, honestly. Gone to our base of members and been like, these people, you will be asked to vote on BDS if they win. They will turn the union into an activist, a small elite activist group, not a trade union. We should have just fucking hit them hard on that. We were way too like, we're just going to run on our record, really trying to cover our left flank by talking about our progressive politics, our radical politics. It didn't work at all. Like, it was unwinnable because of the whole Occupy feeling, but we definitely did not run the campaign that we needed to, looking back.
I mean, it's understandable too, considering how like unprecedented it was.
Exactly. I mean, it was kind of like dealing with Trump. Like, no, we didn't, I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign was garbage, and I think she should, hold her head in shame for the rest of her life because of that. But at the same time, nobody had a playbook for how to beat a Donald Trump. Like, how do you, when somebody is just like, I'm just going to double down on being a dirtbag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And also, I just want to go back a little bit to, in terms of like contract negotiations. From like another interview's perspective, they said that the UAW had like this saying that our power is at its greatest the day before the contract expires. Can you explain a little bit more about like what exactly that statement means?
That's definitely was a tactical difference and like a legitimate tactical difference of opinion. Mm. But yes, the people who trained us, who had come out of the original fight, the original recognition fight. So this was another thing that was really annoying, is that we'd actually built a culture in the academic student employees on the West Coast of taking people that came up in the rank and file and hiring, getting them hired as UAW international staff. So we were like running, so we all knew each other. We'd come out of the same kind of work. We had a similar kind of perspective. And so that's why when they were organizing in Washington at University of Washington, we sent people up there to help them organize. They sent people down to help us organize CSU. We all worked together to organize the postdocs. We started to organize postdocs up in Washington too. It was like, and it was very much like a program, a project, of being like, if we build enough of these kinds of locals, we could take over the UAW region for the actual, for the whole UAW. And like, build, and then even not be just organizing academic student employees. Let's get in there and start organizing in aerospace and manufacturing and all the areas that the UAW like naturally represents but haven't been organized. But like, we weren't gonna self-marginalize within the UAW. And this is union politics 101. If you've got a plan in the union, you don't go to the leaders and say, our plan is to keep building power and get rid of you and change the union. That's stupid. You put a target on your back, they take you out or marginalize you. So we weren't like publicizing on our website, join us, we're gonna change the UAW. We're like in conflict with the bad forces in the UAW. That would have been stupid. So, but like the dissidents, the ADU types, you know, they were like reading labor notes and all these books critical of the UAW leadership and thought the UAW leadership were all garbage. So they were like, we should say that as a local. And so because we wouldn't say that, then they were just like, you're just like them. But we're like, that's little kid politics to be like, just say your piece. Like strategic politics is, you know, build your forces till you can win. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but that comes down, that plays down to how the international union was portrayed in our faction fight. So yes, our international reps, so the people who worked for the international union, for UAW, but who worked to service our local, had come out of this, they were former graduate students who'd come out of this struggle, who were big in the recognition fight, the original strikes, all of that. So, and what they had learned from being trained as a UAW organizer and negotiator is the UAW's playbook for negotiation. And it very much is two things. One is, you know, really use the contract expiration date as for leverage and be like, and like build up so that you have a really credible strike threat and the university knows you could do a really big strike and really hurt them all the way up to that point and then get the best deal you can at that point. And part of that is like building up. And so the second big thing, and this is a very public sector thing, this wouldn't work for GM, but for the public sector in California, it works that we were filing grievances, unfair labor practice grievances, all during the negotiating period, because that's the only legal way that you can go on strike while the contract is still in effect. So it was like you ever played soccer? So you know how like in good aggressive fast-paced soccer offense, right, you want to just like really keeping the ball on the other side, on your opponent's side as much as possible. And you move your halfbacks up and you move your fullbacks up, right? To keep it on the other side. And part of that is like, so you have scoring opportunities, but part of it is what happens when the other team makes a fast break? They're very likely to get offsides and then you stop the game, right? So it's a catching them offsides strategy. So we would do all these things to catch the university in breaking bargaining laws, so we could file unfair labor practice grievances and then we could strike legally. And that was like, again, to show the force. So yes, it was all like build up the strike threat, get the best deal that you can. And their argument, their philosophy was let the contract expire, take a really long time, build up a strike, go on strike for a really long time, get a better contract. And I just don't think that's true. I think it's that there's a lot of wisdom in the idea that like the thing about a strike is its threat. And that once you actually do it, you've sort of played those cards. The university knows how much real support the strike has. And then you're in an attrition game. And you know, like it's not that hard to break a strike by people who make very little money, whose supervisors decide over their entire academic future, who, you know, all those reasons, it's pretty easy to get people to cross a picket line, unfortunately. So Anyway, so that was, yeah, that's a tactical difference. But they made it sound as if there's like a call from Detroit from the head office to our bargaining leaders being like, you have to bargain this way, you know, and that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. And then the other like 100-pound gorilla in the room right now, you know, from where we sit today, is that the leaders of the UAW for our region, like, so the people that I had to deal with in the international, like literally those people are going to jail right now.
Oh,
like, go, like fucking the most egregious, like just corruption, greed, stealing from the union. Mm. Like, the guy who was the deputy regional director. So, you know, UAW has these regions that are very powerful in the union, like in terms of the structure. So like the guy who was the number two guy in that region when I was active eventually became president of the UAW, which when I saw that happen, I was like, that's not good, because it's like the, you know, it's like the D team, you know, like it wasn't the B team or the C team of the leadership. It was like, oh my God. So, yeah, Gary Jones. So he's going to jail. And the thing was, like, we knew they were terrible. We knew they were awful. And we never, but we also knew that the way the labor movement worked was, you, if you have a fight, you have to win or you die. It's Game of Thrones, basically. So, so we just sort of like, you know, go along to get along, didn't do them any favors or anything, but like didn't challenge them. So, but like, it wasn't that hard if you were an AWDU activist to like see who these people were, see that we weren't fighting them, find pictures of us together at conferences and be like, look, they're all the same. So they were able to paint us as like an example of bad, corrupt union leadership. When the fact was, like, we were very aware of what was going on and how terrible they were and wanted to get rid of them. But we knew that you don't get rid of them with a blog post. So, yeah, that was the difference.
And also, I know you touched on this a little bit earlier, but so when you were coming up in the organization, you kind of mentioned how there were, like, trainings with the people involved. So can you explain a little bit more about that process and like the overall culture of people, like before AWDU and all that?
Right. So our culture was that if you were an officer of any kind, so a steward, a head steward, campus unit chair or secretary or whatever, or on the executive board, so a statewide officer, that you were expected to go out and sign up members for hours a week. And it was like, you had, if you were paid, if you were in one of the paid positions, then it was like 60% of your time. If you were unpaid, it was still like our kind of like goal was like, if you were a steward, you'd do 6 hours a week. If you were head steward, you'd do 10 hours a week, maybe a little off on those numbers. But there was, you know, that was the goal and the expectation. And that's a lot. And it's totally hard work. It's not fun. It's not like sitting in a meeting of people who all already agree. It's having to have frustrating conversations with people making dumb reasons for not joining the union. And having to, like, you know, play along, not just beat them in the argument, because you don't get their card. You don't get them to join if you just beat them in the argument. That's, you know, it's just like electoral organizing, lots of different kinds of organizing where, like, you can prove that the other person's wrong, but you didn't get them to come over and vote for your guy. So it didn't, it's just a waste of time. So anyway, so the culture was like, in that sense, kind of militaristic, with a very clear hierarchy and a very clear set of responsibilities. And I think that was, it was a problem. I think the culture was too militaristic. But it came out of, it was developed by people who had come out of this existential fight for recognition. They knew what the university was capable of. They knew that the university was capable of, like, manipulating GSA or grad or like dissident groups in the union and so forth to destroy our bargaining power. So it was a kind of tough, very tough-minded approach. But anyway, but the culture was like, if you wanted to get involved in the union, like, then a more experienced organizer would meet up with you and go around with you in your department or somewhere and sign up members. And that was your first introduction. It was not a meeting. It was not like a PowerPoint about the labor movement. It was like, let's go sign up people for the union. So, and then it was like the trainings that we would have would be about how to better sign people up or how to do this. And then of course, like all the, and then grievance handling was a really big deal. So, you know, it's the union is responsible for representing anyone in the bargaining unit. So even non-members, you don't have to be a member, representing them in any kind of dispute with their supervisor. So that was a big part of it, was handling grievances. Mm-hmm. And then we saw grievances as, you know, not like a bureaucratic silly thing, but as like a place where militancy and organizing could happen. So here was another division that I found really interesting that would come up all the time was like, and when it came to grievances, in any grievance procedure, the grievant, the person filing the grievance, has to put their name on it, has to file it, has to be there. The union is just a platform, like it provides somebody there with you to give you advice, to speak on your behalf. It helps you fill out the paperwork, all of that. But like the worker has to stand up for themselves. Mm-hmm. And they always, the other, Audu always wanted to put things in the contract that would like not require a grievant to do that. So it'd be fixed sort of magically and bureaucratically that someone could go and say, I have a workload problem and not have to confront their fucking professor or supervisor. And it would just be fixed by the union behind the scenes. And like, that's what? You're the militant radicals, but you want to protect people from having to like look their boss in the eye and saying there's a problem? Like, what is this? And it was really clear to us that it was like, these are all people who are best friends with their Marxist scholar advisors. And like, they don't want to have those uncomfortable conversations, you know? And like, whereas like our rank and file, like the bulk of our members were like, not the academic rock stars that were like kissing everybody's ass. So our view was much more that they were workers. And in this scenario, they're workers talking to their boss as equals. It's not personal. It's not because they hate their boss. It's not an emotional thing. It's just, it's a violation of the contract and we're going to fix it. So training people to go out and aggressively find grievances, talk to people, ask people the right kinds of questions to find out if there's a grievance, and also convince people to take the action and file the grievance. That was a big part of the skill set that we tried to get our leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say there was a lot of like mentorship, like when you would have like an experienced person going around with an inexperienced person?
Yeah, it was programmed. I mean, mm-hmm. It was like an intentional thing. People would be assigned to work with new people.
Mm-hmm. Did you see like a breakdown in this like sort of community structure once like people started like getting solidified in their own factions?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically from the contract, you know, the big fight that we had over ratifying the contract to the leadership elections where we got smoked, mm-hmm. like that period of time, the program was done because everything was factional. Mm-hmm. So everything we did, they were counter-organizing, everything was like, you know, it was all through that prism, it sucked. So from basically that old, really like organizing focused, professionalized, you know, militarized kind of discipline was already breaking down and it was just becoming a big, just the internal fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then by the time, like, I remember talking to people like a year or two after, and it was like, even people hadn't heard of our database. And I was like, well, it's in the database, right? And they're like, database, what? I'm like, don't you have it on your walk sheets? And they're like, what are walk sheets? So we spent a bunch of resources creating this database. Mm-hmm. And of course, fighting with the university to get the membership, you know, correctly and in the right format, get the list of workers. But basically, we have this database so that, you know, every quarter, the list of workers pops into our database. It matches up the people that are already members, highlights the people that are not. And then there's all these interfaces for organizers to go and find information about where those workers are, where their office is, their office hours, if they have them, when their section times are, put it in there. And then you could print out a list for your day And it was like, you know, Francis Wu is holding office hours at, you know, in the grad tower at 10 a.m. And then Duraca finishes his section, his discussion section in music at blah, blah. And so you just go down and have those conversations and talk to those people, right? So it was like, and then put in what the response was and everything so that your supervisor in the union, like your lead, could look at that and see how you're, but that, so it was disciplined. There was accountability. You could be fired if you weren't doing it right. All of those things. ADU people wanted none of that kind of shit. Like any kind of like oversight and discipline was, you know, bureaucratic and reactionary and authoritarian. And I don't think they used that database ever. Mm. They really went to a model of, it was like, have department meetings, get meetings together, meetings in departments, have people sit and talk. And it was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've learned in the left is there's too many fucking meetings and we fetishize them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so after the ADU elections happened, how long did you stay on with the UAW? Were you still part of?
Oh, no, I was out. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I paid my dues. I was a member, mm-hmm. but until I graduated. But but in terms of leadership, I didn't have any position.
Mm-hmm. Did you see any? Besides them, like not using the database and like not having the same sort of like organized, like going out and like talking to other people and things like that. Did you see them implement any new kind of like guidelines for members? Or like what did they do sort of as they took over aside from
what I saw? Yeah. The things I saw was, so there was the BDS thing. Mm-hmm. There was the creation of a bunch of committees, like the social justice committee or like anti-oppression. That's what it called, anti-oppression committee. A lot of committees, which is fine. And again, I'm self-critical looking back that we didn't provide nearly enough space for people to do just kind of creative political things. And we made that too much of a zero sum with the organizing. We should have said, yes, go do those things, but you have to organize. So that was a mistake on it. But it seemed like it just was all that. It was just all meetings, issues not related to bargaining. And then the other thing that they did, right, was, which was good, like in the next bargaining campaign, like the next contract negotiations, right, they really emphasized, like trans rights and, you know, bathroom access justice and things like that. And that is the way that they emphasized it in the bargaining campaign was different than we would have, I mean, for sure. Because we wouldn't have, yeah, it was weird how they kind of signaled to the university that that was the number one priority when the university wasn't really that opposed to it. So the way they leveraged it seemed like it was very much about the internal politics of wanting to signal that certain issues were important to the union, but that was more about their own internal audience.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So I think, those are a majority of my questions. What, in your opinion, was the strongest action taken by the UAW in the fight for grad students' rights overall?
Well, I mean, I really feel like the most fundamental victory is just the existence of the union itself and the fact that there's something intervened to make rational and legal and visible, like, this power relationship between academic student employees and the university. You talk to anybody who was in graduate school before unionization, mm-hmm. and or talk to people that are in graduate school in places without a union, and you just, you know, the abuse is incredible, and the, you know, go get my dry cleaning, you know, go, they become like little peons and serfs for their professor masters, and that's like not right. Mm-hmm. So Just being able to bargain over working conditions, being able to talk about working conditions as working conditions and not just the lumps you take to become an academic and the dues you take to be a good scholar. But say like, no, this is exploitation. You're exploiting my labor and treating me terribly. Mm-hmm. So just that fundamental change in the relationship, I think, is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, changing the narrative. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, what is your opinion on the current coal movements that are happening right now?
I don't have a strong opinion about it. It's confusing and concerning to me in that, like, it seems like another wave, like the current leadership is being flanked by the left and attacked. And so, you know, my immediate, having my trauma and my experience, my immediate sympathy is with the leadership of the union. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand. I've been meaning to like talk to people that are closer to it and but here's what I think is weird. I think that it's weird that the smallest campus took unilateral action and was like negotiating on its own, which like totally undermines all the other campuses. Mm-hmm. I think that doing it outside of the union process instead of, hey, let's build for a COLA for everyone in the next round of negotiations is pretty telling and a problem. Also, I don't think those people should be fired, obviously. And also, I think that people should get raises. I mean, it's like absurd. I know very well how low the wages are. Why not build the union and do it through the union? This, like, the instinct and the fact that it came from Santa Cruz, which has always had this toxic leftier than thou culture, made me skeptical. But mm-hmm. I haven't drilled down. I could be totally off base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was also wondering if you had any access to the previous UAW contracts,
Well, that's a good question. I mean, are they not on the website? Well, I guess they wouldn't put the old ones on the website, would they?
Yeah, it's only the 2018 to 2022 one up there right now.
Have you asked the union?
Yeah, and they put me in contact with you, and then several other people.
Who at the union put you in contact with me?
I think it was Jonathan Coach.
Okay.
Yeah, he just let me know that you would have a lot more information. Like,
I don't think I know that person, but mm-hmm. yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. But the other people that I've contacted, only a couple have gone back to me, and they said that they don't have access or like they can't locate all the old ones.
Okay. The people that you should talk to try to locate them, I mean, they're definitely at the statewide office, like for sure. Mm-hmm. So you could be a little more aggressive with them and just be like, hey, I'm just looking for old copies. I'll reimburse you for postage or whatever. I just want old copies of the contract. They have them. They're in a drawer there, 100%.
Okay.
Why don't you call? He will be very careful with what he says to you because he's mm-hmm. international staff. I'll give you his email address. So I think it's mmiller@uaw.net. But you want to try to talk to Mike Miller. He's an international rep. And he knows where everything's buried.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But like I said, he probably won't want to talk on the record about his thoughts about these things. But if you have factual things, I'd like the contract. When was the first contract ratified? When did the all of those things he'll be happy to answer and point you in the right direction and so forth. And you can tell him that I recommended him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But all those things are public. So the contract is a public document because mm-hmm. we're public employees. You know, as part of the bargaining process, in fact, like there's this thing you have to go through. It's like a ceremony of sunshining mm-hmm. where like both sides have to come with their proposals to a public place and sit there. So any member of the public can like come and look at them because it's tax dollars. It's a public agency. So like they have the right to know. It's weird. But yeah, you have, they shouldn't be able to block you from it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. So those were all of my questions. Was there anything else you'd like to add to the interview?
No, they were really good questions. It sounds like you're off to a good start in terms of piecing together the timeline. I'll talk to a couple other people. I mean, I don't know what your methodology is for finding interviews. If you're using like a snowball method and you want recommendations from me, I'm happy to talk to people and find out if it's okay to share their contact with you and share it if you want.
Yeah, definitely. That'd be great.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm still friends with a whole bunch of my cohort of people both from Santa Barbara and statewide.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much.
Okay, no problem.
And also, are you okay with going on record with things that were said during the interview?
Everything I said is on the record.
Okay, perfect. All right. Well, have a great rest of your week.
You
Um,
too.
and thank you for meeting with me.
My pleasure. Stay safe.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.